Flooding in Louisiana, sea level rise in Florida. Just ahead, a closer look at the connections between them. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the NPR One app. And watch the show, too, with video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. And just ahead, we'll take your calls on the rise of freak floods and extreme weather events around the world, and why climate scientists say they're connected and what we should do about it. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, calling all Braille volunteers. Yes, Braille. For the Florida School for the Deaf and Blind. We'll tell you about that. Plus, the music of U2 inspires, but a new exhibit on the UNF campus shows, sometimes in more ways than one. All of that ahead. But first this hour, southern Louisiana faces continued flood warnings this morning, even as communities struggle to recover from a deluge in the Baton Rouge area over the weekend that killed at least 7 people. It stranded more than 20,000 and left more than 11,000 seeking shelter after historic rainfall. Towns downstream of the area's hardest hit watched anxiously this morning as the floodwaters crested and slowly began receding overnight. Now, the National Weather Service estimates the chance of that much rain falling in any given location over the course of the year at 0.1%, meaning that it's only likely to occur once every 1,000 years. But the trouble is, these freak one-in-a-thousand-year type of events are starting to occur much more often than once in 1,000 years, but with regularity. Headlines give the impression that normal life is punctuated every few weeks by an isolated disaster like the one in Baton Rouge. Before that, there was a big flood in July in Maryland, another one in June in West Virginia. There was crazy rain in Texas, followed by damaging fires recently. But in fact, more than 600 such disasters were recorded last year around the world. And the number keeps rising. UNF Professor Alan Tilley has run a listserv since 2004 dedicated to news and research around climate change. And in the wake of Baton Rouge, he's joining climate scientists in sounding the theme that the growing list of climate and weather-related emergencies worldwide add up to a general emergency, one that demands immediate action. Tilley joins us now with his thoughts on flooding, climate, and sea level rise, and takes your calls. Professor Tilley, good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and questions about the rise in severe weather events around the world and their connection to climate change? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet us, or weigh in on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And Professor Tilley, let's begin with Facebook. As I was scrolling through my feed the other day, I saw just absolutely heartbreaking posts from people here in this area who have family connections or friends in Baton Rouge, including our own employee here, Michelle Corum. People who have lost everything in the wake of this flooding in Louisiana. It brings into sharp relief how devastating these severe weather events can be.
Yeah, that's true. My daughter was in Louisiana for a while, and so we got to know some people there. And I think about them and how they're doing, living in the bayous in the south. It's a little difficult to address this because, after all, there have always been floods. My hometown of Paducah, Kentucky, was devastated when the Ohio River flooded in 1931. And the question is, what does climate change have to do with it? I found a piece in the paper this morning quoting Kevin Trenberth. He's a senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And he said that the major floods in Louisiana have a clear human component in them, clear human component. And it's easy to make the argument Every degree that the temperature goes up in the lower atmosphere adds about 7% water vapor. So as the temperature goes up, and we've gone up about a degree since the Industrial Revolution began, so we have a river of water over our heads. Every cumulus cloud you see has about as much water as would equal in weight 100 elephants. So it's a lot of water, and the more water you have up there, well, the more it can come down. The sea surface temperature is going up, so it's unusually hot temperatures in the Gulf now, although not as hot as when Katrina came across. I looked up this morning, and it was 86, 88 degrees. Katrina was over 90, and that's when we saw the hurricane go from Category 1 to Cat 5 and then 4 when it made landfall.
And let me ask you, because these events are occurring with more and more regularity, but still, it can be difficult sometimes to connect the dots between them. You run a listserv, and you have for over a decade, dedicated to doing that. Looking at the connections between these weather-related events, the rise in global temperatures, sea level rise, which is, of course, of great concern here in Florida. And at the same time, on the other side of the ocean, the Global Hazards Weekly Bulletin, which is produced in London, has pointed out that in this year alone, floods and landslides have affected 9 people in China. Mega wildfires are raging in California. Kuwait is broiling in a 129-degree heat wave. Much of India's Assam state is underwater with more than 1 million homeless. A freak heat wave in Siberia is causing havoc. There is a national drought in parts of Africa and a typhoon in Vietnam. Okay. Most of us here in America aren't following those events.
Yes.
But if you look at this on the global scale, connect the dots for us.
Well, the connection is where there is a human footprint. And if you have an earthquake, unless it's from fracking, you don't really have a human footprint. There are some events, volcano eruptions, that as far as we know are just happening as part of the process of Earth. But the connection on the extreme weather events, and there have been 8 extreme weather events in the last year in the U.S., and floods, 8 extreme weather floods. The connection of those to global warming and of many of the other events that you mentioned is fairly direct. You get a much more energetic atmosphere as it warms, and so you get more storms. You have more moisture up there in the atmosphere, and so you have the possibility for extreme rainfall events. It's regional. In this area, we're not projected to get a lot more water in a year than we get now. We already get over 60 inches a year, I believe, which is a lot, around 60, a little bit less. And we'll get that according to the models, except that we'll get less of it in the sort of nice rainfalls that we've had recently and more of it in downpours. So our precipitation won't change that much. But all these things involve people facing misfortune and change. And what we need to cope with that is resilience. Resilience is our ability. Let's see, I looked it up this morning. And resilience, where is it? Ability to recover from or adjust easily to misfortune or change. That's what Louisiana is attempting to do now. One of the ways they're doing it is through the Cajun Navy. They had a number of first responders who were able to get to people who were stranded and rescue them and bring them to shelters, which some of those then flooded and they had to get them from the shelters elsewhere. So the authorities were able to handle a lot of that, but a lot of it too was handled by guys and women out in their boats, just checking on the neighbors. The factor that's going to help us best in resilience, finally, is community. And that's how we're going to be able to cope, I think, with the changes and the misfortunes that we see ahead of us, including sea level rise.
And let's talk about that quickly, especially as it relates to Florida. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with UNF's Alan Tilley about the massive flooding in Louisiana and the rise in extreme weather events around the world. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Bill McKibben, who founded the Climate Action Group 350.org, wrote a piece about this very recently, saying that climate change is not like a world war. It is a world war, and that we need to respond in the same way we responded to the rise of the Third Reich in the late 1930s, early 1940s. He writes, "We're used to war as a metaphor, the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on cancer." And he says that global warming is beginning a stealth campaign that would lay waste to vast stretches of the planet. Instead of paying heed and taking obvious precautions, we've chosen to strengthen the enemy with our endless combustion. Carbon and methane now represent the deadliest enemy of all time, the first force fully capable of harrying, scattering, and impoverishing our entire civilization. Critics would call his words alarmist. What do you think?
Well, they're fairly accurate, and if you read the article, which is well worth doing, what you'll find are a lot of surprising parallels between the way we prepared for and then carried out World War II, our part in World War II. For example, one of the things that we did was to raise victory gardens. I was born in 1941, so in my earliest memories, I remember the plastic rationing tags. I remember stopping the cans so they could be recycled. And I remember having a garden in the backyard. Well, 40% of the vegetables that we ate in World War II were raised in backyard gardens. I have a backyard garden now. I'm trying to grow black-eyed peas. I got too much sun this summer. I'm learning, but I'll get better. And that's one of the things that we can do to be resilient, is to be responsible for some of our own food supply. If we had a sustainable community here in this region, it would grow a lot of its food. It would produce a lot of its energy. It would return the water that came to that community at least as clean as we found it. The growth of sustainable communities will allow us to become more resilient.
Yeah, but before we could even get to that, we are not all on the same page in this country when it comes to whether people consider this to be a serious threat.
Yeah.
So before you can even talk about building sustainable communities, how, in your view, can this country respond in a unified way? In the World War II era, the country was unified. We're not unified today. And this is such a politically divisive issue that building consensus seems to be extraordinarily difficult.
It's true. And on the other hand, so many people are seeing these events. They're not being covered as connected to climate now, but they should be. Kevin Trenberth is clucking his tongue in this article about the lack of mention of climate change in connection with the...
So you think whether we're covering a flood in Baton Rouge, wildfires are breaking out more and more often, massive drought, you believe the media is failing in terms of how they're framing these weather events and reporting on them?
It's certainly true, and there have been several articles in the media about...
So it's not a universal failure.
No, not a universal failure.
Well, let me quote from another media outlet. After the landmark Paris Climate Agreement, Earth scientists around the world announced alarm that the West Antarctic ice sheet is nowhere near as stable as they had thought, and that if serious carbon reduction targets aren't met, that ice sheet is going to melt much more quickly than earlier research had predicted. The likely effect, according to the New York Times, quoting these climate scientists, would likely be to drown the world's coastlines, including many of its great cities, including Miami, Florida, New York City, New Orleans, and many other cities around the world. When we talk about that potential dystopian future, I think a lot of people hear that and think, oh, come on. It just seems too horrifying for people to get their head around. It's like watching an action movie set in this far dystopian future that is just made up.
Well, one of the things that we can notice is that we're getting tidal flooding in Jacksonville now that we haven't had. We had it last fall. And once that begins, because the sea level is not going to drop, it's simply going to go up. In fact, it's going up faster along the east coast of the United States than it is in most places in the world. In Miami, it's going up at over an inch a year and for the last 10 years. So we're going to get our tidal flooding again. If you went to San Marco to watch the manhole covers dancing in the floods coming up out of the sewers, the drains, then we'll see that again this fall. We'll see much more of it. A third of the people in Florida have seen tidal flooding. So it's more and more a matter of direct experience and less a matter ideology or scientific acumen. So as we have more and more direct experience, it's something that we'll simply have to deal with.
People do have to see it to believe it, in other words.
Well, when people see it, they do believe it. Many people are able to understand that it's occurring without being a witness.
Okay, let's go to your calls right now as we speak with Professor Alan Tilley of UNF. He's run a listserv since the early 00s, curating news and information about the effects of climate change around the world. And in the wake of the freak flooding in Louisiana, we are taking your calls and discussing this. It's 549-2937 to call in. Jay is on the line. Hey, Jay, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I think it's very significant that anybody who's 30 or older about are part of the last generation to live on the planet Earth in the way it had been for more or less all of history in terms of when the Earth was actually created, that we have done something incredibly significant to the planet. My question is, what are we going to do to clean it up? The carbon in the atmosphere will stay there for hundreds of years. So even if we stop pumping new carbon in today, the temperature will go up. Just like with clean water in the 60s and 70s, we had to clean up our mess then. What do we do to clean up our mess now?
Yeah, thank you for that call. And does the climate agreement I just mentioned that was struck in Paris, is it going to put us on that road?
Yes. Yeah, it's a wonderful first step and a major accomplishment. I mean, you have all these nations that have agreed to take programmatic actions, and they vary by country. But it's a great question, and certainly I've seen that change, and we're just not going to go back. We've had 1 degree of warming, but there's another half degree that's already there locked in to the heat in the oceans, because the 1 degree is atmospheric heating for the lower atmosphere. And there's another half degree in the oceans. That'll come out in the next decades. So we're already at the Paris Agreement aspirational target of 1.5 degrees of warming. But that's not where it stops, because once that warming is there, sea ice, for example, and glaciers melt even more rapidly than it is now, and the Earth's albedo changes. We reflect less sunlight. Sea ice reflects 95% of the light and energy of the sun back out into space. Open waters reflect only about 5%. So we're due for yet another 1.5 degrees of heating from that effect over the next centuries. In other words, we're already locked in to 3 degrees of heating if the carbon in the atmosphere doesn't change. Good news is that as the hundreds and thousands of years go by, carbon goes into solution. It goes into solution as, with rocks. It goes into solution in the oceans. Sea creatures use the carbon dye, fall to the seafloor, and sequester the carbon. We can also undertake to sequester the carbon ourselves. I can see that happening, and rather quickly.
Quoting again from Bill McKibben, turning out more solar panels and wind turbines may not sound like warfare, but it's exactly what won World War II. Not just massive invasions and pitched tank battles and ferocious aerial bombardments, but the wholesale industrial retooling that was needed to build weapons and supply troops on a previously unprecedented scale.
That's true.
Going back to the lack of political will, how do you even bring something like that about in this country? Given the fact that when you look at the polling on this, Professor, a slight majority of Americans have now accepted the science around climate change, but by no means is it a big majority. There is still nearly half the country believes that this is not a threat at all, or if it is, it's a minor one.
I think it's actually a bit larger than that. It's around 70% who accept the science, and in fact, it's over 80%, and that includes a majority of Republicans, and it's about 70% who believe that we need to do something right now. We have a consensus if we'll use it, and I believe that we're on the point of using it. We have a pretty strong program in place, about as strong as administration could make it without being able to pass laws through Congress. And if we follow that, we're already at 1994 levels on our emissions. So we're at the baseline. most countries calculate their emissions on that base. We're at that baseline and headed down. We really need to get to zero emissions by mid-century.
Let's go to Chris on the west side. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good, Melissa. How are you doing today?
Doing great.
Good. Just more of a comment. You know, it's funny the professor just said that most Republicans believe in it, but believe that climate change is occurring and the science behind it. However, it really seems, especially here in Florida, where we could be a leader in this, we aren't. You know, I mean, you have Rick Scott, who is an avowed climate change denier, and it certainly seems like the majority of the, you know, Florida state representatives and congressmen are certainly, the Republicans at least, are certainly against it. And it's just, it's a shame that that's the case. That's just a comment I wanted to make.
And it's an important comment. The leadership in the Republican Party is definitely against it. But while people in the Republican Party, that is the non-office holders, are learning things, that's going to trickle up in the economic phrase. And as it does, the people will lead and the leaders will follow. And that's the way it more or less always goes.
And speaking of which, down in Miami-Dade and Broward counties, there is strong bipartisan consensus on how to mitigate the effects of sea level rise, which is happening now in South Florida, happening and causing destruction of property. You see a pretty strong consensus down there because, as you said, once the waters start coming in, then it gets real and people start figuring out, okay, what are we going to do about this?
Yeah. Well, our former governor, Charlie Crist, was a national leader in planning and in preparation on climate change. So the leadership on this in this state has been Republican in the past, and I suspect is likely to be again as long as the Florida leadership stays Republican, because the party is simply going to have to change. We're going to have to deal with this.
And it's 549-2937, Tracy in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I have about 4 acres land, and a lot of fruit trees are growing. I have tried over the last 20 years to grow a lot of vegetables, but big failure. I don't know what can be the reason the fruits, the tropicals are growing. And the last comment is, we did put a big solar panel on our roof, and our electric bill have gone down almost 50%. And comment, where can I find out how to grow vegetable in my yard? Thank you.
Sure.
Oh, that's great.
Thanks.
Boy, have I worked on that. I've done everything. I mean, I compost. I've bought soil. I have so many tree roots in my yard that what I'm reduced to is to growing in containers. I have 8 earth boxes and other containers, and that's what I'm doing my gardening in. And that does produce enough tomatoes in the winter, and you know, greens and spinach. But you know, in the summer in Florida, unless you like okra and eggplant and black-eyed peas, you can forget growing anything. As far in my experience, that's the only thing that'll grow in the summer here.
Huh. Okay. Chip is in St. Augustine. Hi, Chip. How are you?
Hey, not bad. My comment kind of follows the guy that was talking about the governor. We have a governor who's denying climate change, even forbids the use of the term climate change. So we're kind of defeated. We need to get the political word out to get rid of anybody who actually says the phrase, there's no such thing as climate change. That's really kind of our only hope. So I'm thinking that we need more billboards, more information campaigns. Of course, this means government money, and in our state, that's going to be a difficult thing to do. But I'm wondering about the uphill battle we've got to actually get people to elect officials that are on our, you know, with our cause.
Yeah, thank you, Chip. And let me ask you that as well, Professor, because when you study confirmation bias, and this has been documented extensively in recent years, not just around the issue of climate, but other issues, the more you show someone data showing that their opinion on something is wrong, the more strongly they dig into their beliefs.
That's right.
So putting up billboards, doing programs like this, in a lot of respects, all it does in the end, may be somewhat self-defeating. All it does is cause others to firm up their opposition to the data. So how do you even deal with that?
Well, you know, I'm going to come around a bit of a short roundabout. Another word that the governor, according to the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, it broke the story on the ban on mentioning of climate change. Another word that he did not want people to use was sustainability. And one of the reasons that I'm trying to put that word out is that what we need, it's difficult to build your life around something that you're not supposed to do. But not doing something is not much of a life plan. What we can do, though, is to see that there is a kind of a community that we would really love to live in, where you can, sustainability is meeting the needs of the present without compromising the needs of the future. If we can do that, then we'll have solved the problem. And so this is the carrot. Sticks are pretty bad psychology, but the carrot of a world in which we're at home, and we haven't really been all at home in this world. We've not been very smart about how we've been living in it, but the world in which we are truly enmeshed and in which we can truly be at home is worth working for. And so I think that the positive vision is worth emphasizing in order to lead people.
Larry, you're in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Larry. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just want to say that I've done this a lot myself, and it's always come out just like I thought. When I run against somebody who's totally against climate change, and then I ask them to explain to me what is causing climate change and how scientifically does it work, they don't have a clue.
Yeah.
Not the first clue. They're getting their information from radio and from people who talk the party line, but they don't know what's going on, and they've got no intention of learning what's going on. That's the frustrating part. Yeah, I implore anybody who runs up against somebody who's really totally thinks it's a fraud and they're totally against it, ask them to explain it to them. That's what I would say.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Thanks, Larry. And that's Larry calling from downtown. And by the way, Professor, you've been running a listserv online since 2004 for anyone that wants to do this kind of research.
Yeah, that's right. Well, if you want to get on it, it's free. I don't deal in propaganda. I don't deal in basic stuff, so it's news. But if you want to be on it, just online, the Green Building Council. I work with them. I've worked with them too. It's the newsletter is under the Global Warming Study Group. So if you Google UNFGWSG, Global Warming Study Group, you'll get there. You'll get the information page and you can sign up.
Harry on the north side. Go ahead, Harry. Thanks for calling.
No problem. Good morning, Professor Tully.
Morning.
I have a quick question, a couple of questions. First of all, how can we, as a society, use sulfur, which I believe has a cooling effect, to possibly balance out the heating effect of carbon on climate change? And my second question is, here in Northeast Florida, I'd like to know what percentage of maybe small business owners are aware of climate change, or you know, how many of them that really have a plan for a natural disaster in this area?
Sure, because thank you, Harry, for that call. You know, the folks in Baton Rouge have suffered so terribly, and I mean, certainly our local emergency response apparatus has to be watching that. What are your thoughts about his question?
The first question on sulfur, sulfur particulates are put up into the air when we burn coal, when we have a fire. And so that particulate is carbon and the sulfur particles. They do have a cooling effect, but they only stay aloft for a few days. So one of the things that happens when you cease emissions is that the temperature goes up. There's about a half a degree of temperature in the atmosphere that's suppressed by those particles, sulfur particles and carbon, reflecting sunlight back out to space. So we're using the cooling effect of sulfur already. There have been proposals to throw enormous amounts of sulfur up there, but if you do that, you got to keep doing it, and you don't know where you're going to have the effect. It's thought to be by many who've written on this to be a pretty dangerous way to imagine taking care of global warming. And one of the, I think, devastating critiques of it is it does nothing to halt the acidification of the oceans. We're in the process of killing our oceans, and if we do that, the planet is going to be in real trouble.
And here's an email for you from Rob. Would the professor please explain why we can't build a dike around Miami or Florida since we have a karst formation where sea level will rise through the backyards of residences through the groundwater? Of course, that would hurt small business, back to the other point.
Back to the other point, but with that point, that great email, it just answered the question. We have karst, and that's a limestone substructure in Florida. So if you should build a seawall, then the substructure is permeable, and the water will just come up on the other side of it. That's why seawalls are really not much use to us. On the small businesses, the thing, I don't know how many small businesses are sophisticated or knowledgeable in this area, but I do know that there are a bunch of them that are now beginning to base themselves on the adaptation to climate and mitigation through solar panels. The solar industry is getting larger and larger. Jacksonville's a great market for solar panels. One of the things that I'm going to do is to vote for the Amendment 4. In fact, I'll probably do it today since the voting has been open. And what that will do is to allow businesses, especially, well, any kind of business, to put a solar panel on their roof and escape the tax on that. And so it's a way of supporting the increased use of solar panel by businesses. That will increase the businesses that many people are in of now manufacturing, selling, and installing those panels. So it'll have a real effect.
Well, we always welcome your thoughts on this program, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Sure. Glad to be here.
Professor Alan Tilley runs a listserv on climate. You can subscribe just by Googling UNF and the letters GWSG. Later, how the music of U2 is inspiring a unique exhibit in town. But up next, a lifeline for the blind, Braille. We'll tell you why volunteers are learning it to help the Florida School for the Deaf and Blind. Back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, Julie Klausner, creator of the Hulu series Difficult People. She and Billy Eichner star as New York comedians who are failing at becoming famous, but they're pop culture obsessives who spend a lot of time making hilarious, snarky jokes about celebrities, TV shows, movies, and theater. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are pleased to announce that Pedro Noguera, national expert on public education in America, is this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach, Saturday, October 8th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. For more information, visit wjct.org/teach.
When he was a boy, nobody in Rudolf Buchbinder's family played music, but they still had a piano.
It was for the flowers, perhaps, I don't know. And whatever I heard in the radio, I tried to play on the piano.
We'll hear the grown-up Rudolf Buchbinder on the radio playing Beethoven on the next Performance Today from APM. Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, for almost 60 years, Temple Sisterhood at Congregation Ahavath Chesed has sponsored a program that converts printed books into Braille, books that are used by the Florida School for the Deaf and Blind and other institutions. Now, the next training class of these Braille volunteers is getting together right now. And beginning next month, volunteers will go through a free 9-month program where they learn how to transcribe printed text into Braille. They can also convert illustrations into raised images that can be interpreted through the touch of your fingers. Isn't that amazing? Pat Gray and Lynette Taylor are with the Temple Sisterhood Braille Group and join us now, ladies. So good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What an amazing program. I mean, the Florida School for the Deaf and Blind down in St. Augustine is famed for educating Ray Charles, among many other people. But I did not realize that they needed help with Braille textbooks. That's where this program comes in. How did this all begin some 60 years ago?
It began because one of our original members had a son who was blind, and she wanted to be able to provide textbooks for him, so she started the group so that he would have textbooks while he was in school.
Uh-huh. And it's just continued through the years. How do you learn how to do this? It sounds fascinating.
You go to the classes and you are taught the Braille letters, punctuation, numbers, and then there are special contractions in Braille where instead of doing ER as two separate letters, it's just one cell.
So when you do the transcribing process, you take a regular book, you learn the Braille language, and then you actually create the Braille on the page? Do you use a stylus or?
Well, now we use computers.
It's all done by computer?
Yes. Okay. I mean, it was styluses. It was like Perkins Brailer, which is like a typewriter.
Uh-huh.
But now we have computers, which is great because we can backspace easily.
You're seeking volunteers right now. Even though this is at the temple, anyone of any faith can be part of this.
Oh, yes. We're very non-denominational and non-profit, and I think any other non that you can think of.
So anyone can volunteer.
Yes.
And then this is a 9-month program. It's free, though. So
yes.
People need to have some commitment to this, but it is free.
Yes.
Right.
It is free, but it takes the classes and then doing homework and studying. So
wow. And what's the reward for people, do you think, once they get through this?
The reward for people is when you see a child that you have done a book for, and he is so appreciative that he has this book in Braille. And one of the fun things to do is literary stuff for kids who, while they may get their textbooks, they don't have any leisure reading. So we do that too,
yeah,
and that's really fun.
And I didn't even realize this, but you actually can convert pictures via this technique so that people who can't see can feel the image on the page. They can feel it, they can experience it through touch.
Yes.
That's amazing.
They use collage. Mainly we use collage, but we can also use computer. We use that more for things like bar graphs and pie charts. But for maps and for other things, we use collage.
And you even brought a few examples with
you.
Oh, these are really fascinating. The image is raised on the page. Now, of course, our own Michelle Corum directs our radio reading service here at WJCT. It's a special service on the radio for low vision listeners, where volunteers come in and they read the Florida Times Union over a special radio channel and read other printed material. Because I don't think people stop and think how we take for granted our ability to read, and if that was taken away,
how devastating
that would be.
Yes, if you can't read, you lose so much, and you miss so much. So quite often people who, your service is wonderful, because quite often older people, when they lose their vision, cannot learn Braille.
Mm-hmm.
So your service is wonderful for those. And ours is wonderful for kids in school and people who do know Braille.
Sure. Now, as we said a moment ago, the volunteers are going to start this free 9-month program where they learn how to transcribe printed text into Braille. This starts September 1st. How can people get in touch with you ladies and be part of this?
You can email us. We have three people that you could email. Mine is dandltaylor@att.net. And we will be happy to tell you, or you can just show up on the first, or actually we have orientation on the 25th of August. You can just show up
And just show up and be part of it.
And be part of it, yeah.
Yeah, and this is coming up at 10 a.m. Thursday, August 25th. That's next Thursday.
Yes.
At Congregation Ahavet Chesed, the Temple, just known as the Temple as well. And the address is 8727. Okay, somebody transposed it for me. I'm so sorry. 8727 San Jose Boulevard, the Temple on San Jose Boulevard. Come be a Braille volunteer. Just show up there next Thursday at 10 o'clock and join Pat Gray and Lynette Taylor with the Temple Sisterhood Braille Group. What an amazing program, and what a history, too. 60 years on the First Coast. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. And we'll be right back.
And I'm...
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Americans have accumulated $1.3 trillion in student debt. College graduates can earn more over time compared to high school graduates, but many now question the net benefit of a college degree, the student debt crisis, and plans from the presidential candidates. Weekday mornings at 10 on 89.9.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's a unique new exhibit that examines the intersection of identity, personal, and identity, a brand, through the tattooed fans of U2. Ink Icons Identity, exploring U2's brand through fan tattoos, opened Monday on the UNF campus. It's an exhibit of the U2 Tattoo Project. Curator Beth Nobby is here. And where's your tattoo, by the way? Do you have one?
I don't. I don't have a U2 tattoo or otherwise.
But you have a U2 t-shirt on. So
I am. I'm representing the Joshua Tree.
You're representing the Joshua Tree. I love that album. Now, I had no idea that this was a thing. How cool is this? How did and what is this all about?
I'm documenting U2 fan tattoos. I've been a fan of the band since I was 13. I'm also a graphic design professor. And so I realized within the last few years that I could merge my passions with my academic research interest, it just all completely clicked. So I've been studying U2's visual identity for a few years, and within the last year and a half, I've started studying fan tattoos.
And are U2 fan tattoos particularly interesting and creative, I would guess, maybe?
They're fascinating, and the reason for that is because there's such a diverse spread. U2 doesn't have that singular iconic mark like a band like the Rolling Stones do, and that's really what motivated the project, is to see the diversity of what fans do get tattooed.
What do they do? But yeah, you're right, because classic bands kind of have a logo. The Stones have the tongue. Mm-hmm. AC/DC has this really definitive looking logo, now that I think about it. The Who, and then younger bands do too.
Absolutely.
U2 doesn't really have one.
They don't. They have this sort of visual restlessness, that, which I think represents the band very well. They're about experimentation and redefining themselves with every era. And so you see fans getting the different type treatment logos from the different eras and albums. You see them getting different symbols and icons and marks. You see them getting photographs of Bono. It's a huge range.
Huh. And how were you able to take the tattoo imagery and make it into an art exhibit?
I have a wonderfully supportive department over at the University of North Florida who has encouraged this really sort of unconventional research. And my research partner, Chris LeClaire, is a visual anthropologist and amazing photographer. So it's a display of his imagery, my research, my knowledge of the artifacts in the band. And it just comes together in an exhibit that celebrates the U2 art in these fans. And tattoos.
Has U2 heard of this exhibit?
They have. They're aware.
They know about it.
We were. We went to 19 concerts in 2015, and
you're not an obsessed fan at all.
I prefer passionate and enthusiastic.
right. Sure.
And you know, U2 is very accessible to their fans, and so they'll come out before concerts and do sort of meet and greets. And we had a few opportunities to, you know, kind of shout a few questions at them, find out who in the band is tattooed, and their latest album cover features the only tattoo of a band member. And so it's all sort of very relevant right now.
So they, it has their blessing, in other words.
I hope so. I think so. I think they like, you know, it's an extension of their brand, and it's a way to connect with fans and see how fans celebrate them.
And what's cool about this, too, is people can go and see the exhibit, Ink Icons Identity. It's up on the UNF campus through the rest of August at the UNF Gallery of Art. That is in Founders Hall. You're also going to have a free opening reception Thursday night.
This Thursday. Mm-hmm.
How can people come out to that?
It's on UNF's campus in the Gallery of Art from 4:30 to 8 p.m. And it'll be wine and cheese and rock and roll. We're going to have even a live stream broadcast of a fan getting a tattoo. She's in Seattle, and we're going to be live streaming her getting one of these very popular U2 marks.
Oh, cool. What is it going to be of?
It's a little icon the fandom calls Zoo Baby, which was on the cover of their 1993 album Zooropa and has showed up throughout their career.
Very nice. And then the capstone to all of this is, after your exhibit finishes up at UNF, it is headed to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum. That is pretty amazing.
We're excited. U2 celebrates 40 years as a band together this year. So the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with the fan site at U2.com, is having a huge celebration of them in September to mark those four decades. And we've been invited to display our research and our exhibit and our photos there for it.
That's excellent. I mean, I would think it's pretty competitive to mount an exhibit up in Cleveland. So kudos.
It is. It's an incredible museum.
Wow. It is Ink Icons Identity, exploring U2's brand through fan tattoos. This is an exhibit of the U2 Tattoo Project. Yes, that exists. And the exhibit is up now at UNF's Gallery of Art in Founders Hall, a reception there this Thursday night. And after it's all over here in Jacksonville, these images make their way to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. So, curator Beth Nobby, keep rocking, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum is running the board. Our show theme is composed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Diane Reams up next with a look at why students have accumulated so much in student debt in this country. What to do about the student debt crisis is next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Enjoy a little more U2.
In your side, I'll wait for you. Sleight of hand and twist of fate, on a bed of nails she makes me wait, and I wait without you.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Hello, this is Todd Smith, your Deputy Director for the City of Jacksonville's Emergency Preparedness Division. Disasters can strike with little to no notice. Create your disaster kit now, including water, non-perishable foods, batteries, flashlight, weather radio, and important documents. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9. The designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by Colo CSX Data Center Hosting Solutions.